I'm Jessica Hunt. I'm a producer for The Exchange. And one of the things that we do when we are pulling together a show is consider how our listeners are going to tap into that subject. And we don't take for granted the huge engagement that we get. Emails, calls, social media, many ways that listeners engage with The Exchange. If you would like to financially support that conversation and support public radio, giving is easy to do at nhpr.org, or you can just follow the link right in the show notes. And thanks.
Support for The Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest and You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. New Hampshire doctors are writing far fewer prescriptions for opioids these days, and the same is true nationally, according to research by the healthcare analysis firm IQVIA. In fact, its recent study says New Hampshire had a 15% drop in these prescriptions last year. Many reasons have been cited: the state's prescription drug monitoring program, tighter insurance and regulatory controls, greater doctor and patient awareness. Today in The Exchange, we look at what these numbers tell us and what they don't tell us. And let's hear from you. What do you read into this report suggesting a significant drop in opioid prescriptions? Send us your email by exchange at nhpr.org. Again, exchange at nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. NHPR. We have three guests in the studio. Joining us is Dr. Richard Barth, professor of surgery at Dartmouth's Geisel School of Medicine, chief of the section of general surgery at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center. And Dr. Barth conducted a study that was widely quoted about the use of opioids for acute care after surgery. Dr. Barth, good to meet you. Thank you for coming in.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Dr. David Nagel, a physician who specializes in pain management at Concord Orthopedics. He's the New Hampshire representative to the American Academy of Pain Medicine and author of the book Needless Suffering: How Society Fails Those with Chronic Pain. And Dr. Nagel, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you.
Also joining us is Michelle Rico Jonas. She's program manager for New Hampshire's Prescription Drug Monitoring Program. And Michelle, a big welcome. Thank you for being here.
Good morning.
Well, I want to start with you, Dr. Barth, but hear from everybody. How much do you see in your own hospital doctors prescribing fewer opioids? Does that 15% drop that I cited sound realistic to you?
Oh, it sounds very realistic. I think a lot of the work that we've done in the acute pain setting has identified that doctors have been overprescribing opioids to patients. So when we've looked at and called patients and seen how many opioids they take after common operations, we noticed that they only take about 25% of the pills that they're prescribed. So therefore, we've been overprescribing for many years. And what surgeons really needed to do was basically come along and understand how many patients are actually using and therefore prescribe an appropriate number of opioids for those patients.
So doctors were just routinely, after surgery, sending patients home with way more than they were actually consuming, and then they're sitting around the house and who knows what happens to them.
Correct. I think all of us, when I was in medical school back in the 1980s, we were taught that if people are given a prescription that they for acute pain, that they can't become addicted. That's very, very rare for people to become addicted to opioids. And in fact, that's not the case. There are now many studies out there that show that between 5 and 10% of patients who are opioid naive, who are prescribed opioids for operations, end up taking opioids long term, that is 6 months or a year after. And so now we have to take that into account for our own patients. There are studies that show that the longer patients take opioids, that the higher the percentage are that are long term opioid users. So our whole goal is to try to prevent people from becoming long-term opioid users by just prescribing the appropriate amount of opioids to those patients in the very beginning.
And again, this drop that we've seen in New Hampshire and nationally over the last 5 years, but in particular the last couple years, is this a positive trend, Dr. Barth?
I think it's a very positive trend, especially when you're prescribing for acute pain episodes. So both the patients are at risk for themselves becoming long-term opioid users, but then there's also the problem with diversion. So those pills that aren't used when they're initially prescribed can be diverted to others, and that can lead to problems with those patients too. So our goal is to really just prescribe the correct amount, the appropriate amount to patients so that their pain is relieved with the surgery that they're having and that there aren't a lot around that will lead them to become long-term users or that can be diverted to others.
Yeah, and a little bit later in the show, we should definitely talk about other alternatives for people who are suffering from pain, whether acute or chronic. And Dr. Nagel, how about you? When you hear the 15% drop statistics, a lot of people might think, wow, that's great. How do you hear it?
Well, I'm really sad to say that I agree with everything you just said. However, I mean, we deal with a population of people with chronic pain, and that's,
which is different.
It's ongoing a much more pain. Complicated issue. We do know that a subset of people with chronic pain will do very well with long-term opioid management if it's done carefully, cautiously, and something we've been preaching for years. The only thing that I would disagree with you about, having gone to med school in the same time frame, we were taught that everybody was at risk for being addicted. So I get that's clearly not true also. I think the numbers that you said were pretty accurate.
So is this positive or not? Because you and I have talked before about, you know, pain refugees,
yes,
people
no.
who can't get what
exactly.
they need and so forth. Go ahead.
So there's a third public health crisis called the opioid refugees, people that have been managed well for a long period of time that can no longer get access to opioids. And then there's people that would benefit from long-term opioid therapies that are not getting it. And what my big concern is that we're seeing arbitrary discontinuation of opioid prescription in people that are doing well, arbitrary cutting back of doses in these same people. And because of that, you know, they're suffering needlessly. I have a text from a patient right here today. It says, why are we being made to blame? Why are we being blamed for all these other issues when we were doing just fine and following the rules? So there's always a story behind every number. The number has been decreasing for years. I agree totally in the acute setting that the number had to decline. I think in the chronic setting, we see simultaneous problems with over and under prescription. And I think a lot of work is going on right now to try to identify those people who can benefit and not deny them access to a meaningful therapy.
Well, and we're hearing more about suicides because people can't get the pain medication mm-hmm. that they need. And it's overwhelming.
Yeah, there's a very public suicide recently that's going to lead to some significant legal action. It's in the region. It's not New Hampshire. It's in Vermont, but it included New Hampshire doctors. And the gentleman was arbitrarily denied his medication. It was published in the Pain Network News, and he'd been on for 20 years. He went home and shot himself in the head, which then made him a statistic for gun violence as opposed to, a person that was doing relatively well and denied access just to fit a number, a criteria. And I think the thing that I like about pain management is that we look at the whole person, we look at their entire setting, we look at every detail that has to do with them if we do it right. And when you look at people in that manner, you see them in a very different way. And we know that people like him are doing all right, you know, and it's not fair to those people.
Well, and I want to bring you into this too, Michelle. Again, you are the program manager for New Hampshire's Prescription Drug Monitoring Program. New Hampshire, just remind us, was, what, the second to last state to get a prescription drug monitoring program started? So just remind us of the backstory
sure.
to what you're working on
sure,
now.
Sure, yes. New Hampshire is the 49th state to adopt the prescription drug monitoring program. The last state, excuse me, is Missouri. And in fact, they haven't adopted a statewide one yet. They're doing it county by county. So they're still not on board yet. But with, so New Hampshire adopted it back in 2012, I believe, but we didn't actually get the program up and going until 2014 with federal funding. And we still haven't really received significant state funding to date. We're in the process, though, with a proposal to the state through some licensing fees that will actually be able to sustain the program. And that's some 4 years later. So we're we're working towards sustainability without having to depend on federal funding.
Yeah, a couple years ago, maybe just 6 or 8 months ago, at the end of 2017, there was an audit that said the prescription drug monitoring program wasn't up to snuff. It wasn't doing what it needed to do. It wasn't attacking the problem of so-called doctor shopping. I just wonder how it's going now, Michelle, 6 or 7 months after that
audit.
Yeah,
so we've been very busy working on that plan as a result of the audit. And actually, at the end of this month in June, we're actually doing a 2-day strategic planning session to address a lot of those issues. So with that, and I think a lot of our conversations with the legislature, and I think many of the legislature had agreed with us, the prescription drug monitoring program, when it was enacted, wasn't really given the resources it needed to have. I was the only staff person for the first 2 years of the program. Not quite sure what one individual can do, given the loftiness of the legislation. The program received an additional staff person 2 years in. So we've been operating on two staff. So with that, we've advocated for additional capacity, one being specifically an analyst to assist us with the data pieces of it, which is really what everybody's wanting, is the data that's coming out of that. So hopefully by July 1, we'll be able to now hire an analyst to assist us. So that's one movement forward. Another capacity issue is to be able to look at compliance to ensure that the data that's going in is really the correct kind of data. So our next approach will be to hire someone that will look at compliance specifically.
And who is supposed to submit prescription information to the prescription drug monitoring program, and who isn't?
So it is required that anybody who dispenses controlled substances in the state of New Hampshire is required to upload that data. So right now, there really isn't any prescriber, like a provider per se, that's dispensing out of their offices. But if they did, they would be required to upload that data. So it's mostly pharmacies in state and out of state. And also veterinarians are required to upload that data into the PDMP.
And dentists, I'm assuming, because they...
So dentists is also... But dentists are not... They historically had would give a patient something, but now they're writing prescriptions and they're getting that filled in a community pharmacy. So there are not many, like I said, very, very few prescribers are dispensing out of their offices. They've given that practice up because they don't want to upload data into the PDMP.
I see.
They're writing prescriptions and then sending it to a community pharmacy.
And then I go to the pharmacy.
Correct.
And I fill the prescription. And then that information is recorded with you guys at the Prescription Drug Monitoring
Correct.
Program. Lots to talk about and lots more questions. But I also want to remind our listeners that you can join us today on The Exchange. We're looking at prescribing practices in the midst of an opioid crisis, why and how they've changed, and how that's affecting patients. Let's hear from you. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Dr. Barth, what is this drop in prescriptions, again, opioid prescriptions? Tell us about the people who don't get the pain relief they seek. Maybe they seek street drugs instead. Maybe they really struggle. I mean, you can look at this 15% drop and go, wow, that's great. But for some people, it's not great. So I just wonder what you think it doesn't tell us.
Sure. Well, when we initially found that we were overprescribing medications, we went and asked patients actually how many they were taking. And then I spoke to the group of surgeons at Dartmouth-Hitchcock about this and really let them know, gave them guidelines for prescribing. And in fact, when we prescribed according to those guidelines, we were able to cut the number of opioids that were prescribed by 50%.
Well, it's a lot.
It is a lot. And I was worried that, you know, some patients might not be getting enough opioids. So I let my the head nurse in our clinic know about that so that she could let us know if she was getting phone calls in about that issue. And what we found was that didn't happen at all. So we then, after just educating surgeons about the appropriate number to prescribe, we then followed those same patients that were having those operations over another 6-month period. And we found that of 224 patients, only one patient needed a refill in their opioid prescriptions. So in fact, we were able to cut the number that was prescribed in half and still take excellent care of everyone's pain. And in fact, only a third of the patients The patients that were prescribed the lower amount, only a third of those patients they only took about a third of the medication still. So we were still overprescribing, even though we prescribed 50% less. So just by educating doctors about an appropriate amount, we were able to dramatically change the number of opioids that we prescribed, and we were still able to take care of patients' pain.
What did doctors give post-surgery patients, and I'll ask you too, Dr. Nagel, about chronic pain patients, before opioids?
Right. Well,
and did that work?
Yeah, part of our appropriate opioid prescribing included a couple of other things. One was that we would talk to patients about using other medications like ibuprofen and acetaminophen.
Okay, so those, Tylenol and Motrin, basically.
Yes, exactly.
According
right.
to their
so
store
those
names.
Medications actually there are several good studies that show that they're very, very appropriate. They're very, very effective at relieving acute pain. In fact, they're even better than oxycodone and some other opioids at relieving acute pain. So I tell all my patients to take the combination of both acetaminophen and ibuprofen first, and then only use the opioids if you really need them, if you're still having pain after that. And that's very effective. It also takes a lot of talking with patients and setting their expectations. So now when I'm initially seeing my patients and I'm talking to them about what to expect with the surgery, I'll say, well, yeah, you're going to have some discomfort. But in fact, you know, we've been studying this and I've found that, you know, 90% of the patients do fine with some ibuprofen and acetaminophen, for example, and, you know, and encourage them to take that first. So you set patients' expectations prior to surgery. And also use other modalities other than opioids. We use a lot of local anesthetics in the wound. And in our larger operations, we use a lot of regional anesthetics when we're doing the surgery. So we really try to minimize the amount of opioids that are used when patients are either inpatients or having outpatient surgery.
It's tricky, you know, listening to you talk, because we also hear, like, you're not supposed to take too much Tylenol. It's bad for your liver. You're not supposed to take too much Motrin. It's bad for your stomach. So it's kind of, you know, you can understand why people might want an alternative. We're told very scary stories about the impacts
of
these medicines.
Medications are very safe medications. Obviously, you wouldn't prescribe them to, like, a whole bunch of ibuprofen to someone who has, you know, kidney problems, et cetera. But the vast majority of patients who are coming in and having elective surgery for acute conditions can be prescribed those medications very safely.
Go ahead, Dr. Nagel. Again, so for patients with chronic pain, not the acute pain that Dr. Barth is working with post-surgery, are there better options than opioids?
Well, I don't want to make it sound like I'm Mr. Opioid, because, you know, I'm as afraid of those drugs as anybody. And if somebody wanted to hand it to me, I'd be really nervous about it. And there was a Mayday study that showed that 85% of people say, if I had chronic pain, I wouldn't want opioids, but I want somebody else to have the right to have them, you know. So it's always somebody else, not me. So, but I've always believed, and we've been talking about this for over 20 years now, that we really need to get the focus off of opioids onto a broader perspective at how we manage pain. It can't just be even just medication. There's so many things out there. And, you know, one of the interesting studies that looked at this at another country that has relatively liberal opioid prescribing, they allow access to all sorts of other therapies, you know, and provide the finances for it, which we don't do in this country, like complementary alternative therapies, physical therapies, even chiropractic and things like that are being limited, acupuncture, on and on and on and on. We don't allow access to those things. So we're basically funneled into a medication or a biomedical model, which puts us, you know, in a difficult situation to begin with. So, you know, the goal of a number of things that I hope we talk about more as we go along, the National Pain Strategy, is to look at broader, looking at other alternative therapies. As far as opioids, though, we do know that there is a subset of patients that do benefit. And the question is, how do we identify them and treat them safely? And the other thing, I hear music, but, you know, at some point, we should also talk about the differences between acute, chronic, or, you know, nociceptive pain versus suffering, because they're very different in how people respond to different medications.
All right. Lots to talk about, including that biomedical model that doesn't really provide a lot of opportunity for other types of approaches toward pain. And of course, Michelle, I have a bunch more questions for you too. So coming up, we'll start taking your emails, phone calls. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, how prescribing practices for opioids have changed. A recent study found that New Hampshire reduced opioid prescriptions by 15% last year, a pretty big drop compared to other states. We're finding out how doctors have changed how they prescribe opioids for both acute and chronic care. And as we're hearing, there are some big differences between those two populations. Let's get your questions, your personal experiences. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Dr. Richard Barth is with us, professor of surgery at Dartmouth's Geisel School of Medicine, chief of the section of general surgery at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center. He's looked a lot at the use of opioids for acute care after surgery. Dr. David Nagel is here. He's a physician who specializes in pain management at Concord Orthopedics. He's the New Hampshire rep to the American Academy of Pain Medicine. And also with us, Michelle Rico-Jonas, Program Manager for New Hampshire's Prescription Drug Monitoring Program. Again, our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. And here's an email that came in, a Facebook comment that came in from Olivia. She says, I work in substance misuse prevention and have seen little to no evidence that opiates are effective for long-term pain management. How are you coming to your findings? And that's for you, Dr. Nagel. Olivia, thank you for the comment.
I think it's a fair question because, we have this concept called evidence-based medicine where we look at, studies that demonstrate things, and we like to make the assumption that there's a study that proves everything. And we know that's not true. In my experience, I've been doing this for 30 years, I would say one of the quotes that Russ Portnoy had made years and years ago was that he felt maybe a quarter of people with chronic pain would benefit from long-term opioid therapy.
That's a lot of people.
Well, yeah. I mean, we're looking at about 35 million people, so a quarter of that. And in my experience is that number is pretty accurate. The problem with opioid management is, again, number one, it can't be the only thing. If it's the only thing, you're not doing a good job. Secondly, it has to require time, intensive thought, counseling with the patient. It's not a 10-minute office visit. And I think that's where the difficult problem comes in this current fragmented medical world is that, we're having less and less time to spend with patients. And, for me, it was an hour visit to go over how to take an opioid, You can't just hand it out.
Well, I think that's a great point. And, looking at all the state rules and regs that there are and the federal CDC guidelines, there's a lot of boxes for doctors to check, conversations they're supposed to have. And it seems like you're getting at this, Dr. Nagel. How realistic is that, given that doctors are also under pressure to, see patients every 15 minutes or so?
Well, if I had my way, we'd turn the clock back 30 years and go back to where we were 30 years ago. I personally don't think medicine's headed in the right direction. I don't like the corporate takeover of medicine. I think doctors have to have the right to be able to practice medicine the way they do as human beings. And as far as all these rules and regulations, I did help write the state rules in 1998. One of my big fears was that doctors would see this and say, oh my gosh, this is too much work, I can't do it. The good news is they never saw the rules, so they never knew they existed. And so that's how we ended up with the problems that Dr. Barth was talking about, was people were just handing opioids out without a lot of thought behind it. The difference now is that patients and doctors are aware of the problems and the rules. And so they're realizing this is a lot of work. And like I'm hearing comments from my colleagues on a daily basis. I'm a surgeon. I don't treat pain. And, these are for people with longstanding issues. And maybe that is or is not an issue, but there's not enough pain management doctors to go around. So how do you solve this problem when primary care doctors now, by entity, are being told we can't prescribe opioids? I had two attorneys tell me, you shouldn't prescribe opioids, the risk is too high. So what do we do for all these people,
Yeah, and there aren't a lot of good other options out there. And so many questions. And, you mentioned pain management doctors, and that made me remember, Michelle, a couple years ago, there was a fair bit of media attention on pain clinics, standalone pain clinics, some doctors who were clearly abusing the system. Do we even have any freestanding pain clinics anymore, or how has the state sort of approached those practices?
So I'm not really aware of what the, you know, the state has done with regards to the pain clinics. In fact, I was trying to look at that because I received some questions. So I'm actually investigating that right now. I just don't have any answers for today. However, to go to your point around, I actually wrote that down. Do we have sufficient resources around providers? I often get a lot of questions around that from folks with regards to the opioid rules, per se.
Go ahead. Yeah.
And oftentimes we get the same kind of comments around, well, my doctor says, you know, they can't prescribe anymore because of the opioid rules and the way the opioid rules are written. And if you actually read them, they're not written that way at all. So I question sometimes if they've actually read them. And I will take the time out to actually review the opioid rules, whether it's a patient that's calling me or whether it's a prescriber that's calling me. And even though it's not my purview, I'm not the regulatory board. It's interesting because the prescription drug monitoring program is part of the opioid rules. They call our office often.
Well, that's interesting. So yeah. Give us a little more insight, Michelle, if you could please, on sort of what kinds of questions you get from the interested public, the docs, the patients, maybe the pharmacists and so forth.
Well, from the prescriber side, it's whether, you know, oftentimes it's what type of, you know, can I, if I'm prescribing, you know, cough medicine, do I have to, you know, do I have to look at the PDMP when I'm doing that? And we don't collect Schedule 5. But the rules
are... And what is Schedule 5? Sorry.
Schedule 5 is... It's Schedule 2, 3, and 4 is what we collect in the prescription drug monitoring program. So any controlled medications that fall within those schedules. So any medications that fall within Schedule 5, which is sort of the least addictive schedules...
We're not collecting those.
So cough syrup falls under.
Even though, for some reason, the last couple of years, I always get asked to see my driver's license when I buy my Robitussin, which, you know, whatever. But
and that's a totally different rule. But what I often counsel folks or providers is: are you treating the person's pain? Or are you treating the person's cough? Because if you go back to the rules, it's about whether you're treating pain as to whether or not you have to query or follow any of the guidelines within the opioid rules. So again, I'm not giving any kind of legal counsel. I actually bring them back to the rules, show them. So if they're a nurse or a doctor, I sort of lend them back to, you know, their regulatory board's website and ask them to read the rules.
But it sounds like I'm getting from you, Michelle, there's some confusion and fear among the medical community about what these rules say.
I'm not sure if it's fear. I think there's confusion, at least from my part. I see, you know, my other folks here saying maybe not, but I think there's got to be more education and a better understanding of what the rules mean, because I think their interpretation sometimes wavers a little bit.
Dr. Barth?
Yeah, I think we have an opportunity to have a lot closer coordination between legislators and physicians with regard to formulating these rules. I can give some examples with our own research. Is that there's part of the legislation is that you should, for acute pain, you're only supposed to prescribe a 7-day supply. But there's actually a lot of ambiguity in that, because if you're the physician actually writing that prescription, a 7-day supply can be one tablet 3 times a day, which is 21 tablets, or it can be actually 2 tablets every 4 hours for 7 days, which is 84 tablets.
Wow, big difference.
Huge difference, right? So what we've tried to do is a very much more patient-centric approach to this. So our studies looked at patients who were having operations that required an inpatient stay, so major operations. And we said, well, how many opioids should we be prescribing for those patients when they go home from the hospital? And we basically looked at how many they took the day before they were discharged and hypothesized that that would be the best predictor of how many that they would use when they went home. And we found that that was absolutely the case. If patients didn't take any opioids the day before they went home, no surprise, they didn't need any when they were home. If patients took 1 to 3 tablets, well, if you send them home with 15, that took care of over 85% of the patient's needs. So we've proposed guidelines that are very patient-centric rather than just saying you should only prescribe a seven-day supply. This is a very patient-specific guideline, so some patients you shouldn't prescribe any. Others you might prescribe more. It depends on, you know, the patient's own individual pain threshold.
Yeah, I'm thinking about, you know, if I were a patient of yours, Dr. Barth, and, you know, in one sense I hear what you're saying. In the other sense, though, especially if you're in a rural area, I think, wow, you know, Dr. Barth, I live an hour from your hospital. Maybe can you send me home with some of that stuff just in case, because it's going to be difficult for me to get it.
Right. And I think that's you know, the first question when we started doing this research was, why do doctors overprescribe opioids for acute pain in the first place? And well, one is we really don't want our patients to have pain after we operate on them. The second thing is that some patients live far away and they'd have to come back to our clinic to get a refill. But that isn't the case anymore in New Hampshire. So we can e-prescribe now. So we can electronically prescribe opioids. And so that is no longer a barrier toward appropriate opioid prescribing for patients that worry about people being too far away. In fact, you know, we have a responsibility to our patients, but we also have a responsibility to the public at large with regard to this opioid epidemic. We can't just keep prescribing boatloads of opioids for patients when people, you know, when diversion's happening and when we have, you know, 42,000 people dying every year in the United States from opioid overdoses. You know, we can't ignore the public health issue anymore.
Again, our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And to the phones, Trixie joins us from Londonderry. Hi, Trixie. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm listening to you all, and you're talking about regulatory with regard to the prescribing of medications. And I wanted to share a personal experience with a concern for what actually is happening inside emergency rooms. A family member of mine was brought by ambulance through an emergency room in a New Hampshire hospital with a heart issue, and they had a heart history, followed by family members, of course, but we followed the ambulance. When we arrived at the emergency room, we were sitting with my husband, and a nurse came in with some pain medication, asked him what his pain level was. He said it was a pain level 2, did not request any pain medication. And when I asked the nurse what they were going to be administering, not that my husband had asked for it, were going to administer fentanyl.
Yikes.
And,
fentanyl.
And right. Yikes is right. And so, of course, ballistically, refused it. My husband didn't want it. He just didn't need it, and told the nurse to take the fentanyl away. And I followed up with a complaint to the hospital, to the CFO of the hospital, the CEO, and then they billed us as though they had administered it to him. So it appeared in his medical records that he had been administered fentanyl. And this hospital has never responded to the complaints that I lodged to our insurance carrier, because they had tried to bill us for it also, and we wanted it redacted from the medical records because he had not had it administered to him. So it appears to me there's a big disconnect between regulatory, what's being prescribed, and then what's happening inside hospitals.
Well, and emergency rooms in particular have struggled with opioids, and people present in severe pain, and then, you know, no one is really sure what the real deal is. And Michelle, do the prescription drug monitoring program rules have specific details about emergency room use?
So anything that's administered inside the hospital does not go into the prescription drug monitoring program.
Oh, I see.
Because it's an administration, so it doesn't go into the P&P. It's only those medications that are prescribed and given to the patient outside of any healthcare facility.
Is that kind of a hole there? Because there's probably a lot of opioids given out.
Not necessarily, because it's – well, so even in an ER, and this wasn't an ER situation, so even though they were in the ER, it was administered. If that patient left with a prescription, there is an exemption of anything under 48 hours. If that patient left with a dispensing of 48 hours, that still would have been exempted.
I see. That's interesting. Go ahead, Dr. Nagel.
I'm not going to really comment on that directly, because there's obviously
it's a lot
of missing
case.
Information. But
right.
There was a thing that came out many years ago where it was called pain was the fifth vital sign, which I think has some value. However, Nurses used to wear these little gizmos on their lapels that said pain with an international symbol for no. And this probably started in the early 90s, if I'm not mistaken. The Joint Committee on Accreditation of Hospitals claims that they had nothing to do with calling it the fifth vital sign. However,
vital signs meaning like blood pressure.
Yeah, exactly. So this became kind of standard practice. And having been on her side of things and seeing stuff like this happen, people were just administering opioids with the idea that your pain had to be a zero. And I saw that with my own family. And I think that that behavior is going out, but it's been ingrained for quite a while. And I think that, that does have to change. I think Dr. Barr's comments about acute pain are like totally accurate, that we need to sit down, treat each person as an individual, which I know in the ER is hard to do.
Well,
it
right.
It can't be peer protocol. And,
yeah.
And especially when you're dealing with opioids, and that we need to sit down and treat people as individuals and find out what makes sense and what doesn't make sense for that individual, not what a protocol says or whatever.
Well, and we talked about all the rules and regs and boxes that, you know, doctors and nurses have to check. But again, in that ER setting that our caller talks about, things kind of go out the window sometimes. So, Trixie, good luck, and thank you for calling. Maureen's calling in. Hi, Maureen. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. I have to say I appreciate the gentleman just saying that, you know, you have to take each person as an individual, because I think that, and I know it's a really bad problem, so I just don't want anybody to think that I'm confused about that. But I think that sometimes it gets swept up, and that everybody who takes a controlled substance is part of this horrible disease that is sweeping the nation. And it's not. If you're prescribed by your doctor, you follow with your doctor, you work closely with your doctor, and you take a controlled substance, it might be because, like I have, tried everything else to control the pain that I have. And I know from experience and the back and forth and trying different medications that the controlled substance I take is the only thing that works for me. But I also feel that I'm part of a witch hunt by the doctor. My doctor has been great. He's been fabulous. But he is now under pressure from the insurance company to lower the level of pain medication that I'm on. And he's giving a time limit to do that. If he doesn't do that, the insurance company has decided that they refuse to cover me. At least that's how it was explained to me. But so instead of having my doctor see me on a regular basis and has worked closely with me for a very long time, somebody up in an insurance company who just glanced at my medical records has decided to push me in with the entire big group and say that this is how much pain medication I need, and then that will help.
Well,
and I'll tell you right now, I lay awake at night, and sometimes I wish that I'm not like suicidal, but I just sometimes wonder why I even just keep going on with the amount of pain that I have.
Well, and Maureen, I'm so sorry to hear about that. And, you know, we did a whole show back in January, actually, I think with you, Dr. Nagel, on chronic pain sufferers like you, Maureen. And it's heartbreaking. And people do lie there going, what can I do? What do you think, Dr. Barth, you know, about what she says? I'm being swept up and kind of blamed for something that, you know, I didn't have any reason to be blamed for.
Right. Well,
and it's working for her.
Yeah. As we're trying to appropriately prescribe opioids for acute pain for patients who haven't been taking opioids, I think this population of patients who are on chronic opioids and are tolerant of opioids, they pose a special challenge to us as surgeons, because we want to make sure we take care of their pain very adequately when they're having surgery. So I want those patients to feel reassured that we will take care of their pain adequately. In many cases, they need more opioids because they're tolerant to opioids than our standard patient who is opioid naive. I think there have been some innovative programs around the country to help patients like that are having scheduled surgery, where they can meet with pain specialists and potentially psychiatrists.
I've got to cut you off, Dr. Barth, but we'll pick it up after a break, I promise. Stay with us. This is The Exchange.
I've been an NHPR member for just about 20 years, and this year I decided to become a sustaining member.
Nancy DeBosque of Keene.
I think NHPR has tremendous value, and it's local, so I really do like to know what's going on in my state and use that information a lot in my work.
Thousands of listeners like Nancy support NHPR with ongoing monthly contributions, and you can too. Invest in independent local news and become a sustainer today at nhpr.org and click on donate.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, prescribing practices and how they've changed in the midst of an opioid crisis. We're looking at how doctors are approaching opioid prescriptions these days, given new rules and regulations and new concerns. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Dr. Barth, just before the break, you were responding to Maureen, who called in and said, look, you know, opioids are the only thing that helped me with my chronic pain. And now I'm getting cut off because of insurance regulations and doctor fears. And you were starting to finish up a point there.
I was basically talking about, well, what as surgeons, what do we do with patients like that? There's a large proportion of patients like that out there. And basically, I want to reassure Maureen that, you know, we will take care of your pain adequately when you have surgery. You know, a lot of times you'll need more opioids than our average opioid naive patient coming into surgery. There have been some innovative programs that have been set up around the country, and we're starting one at Dartmouth where patients will potentially see a pain specialist and a psychiatrist prior to their surgery so that they can ferret out whether maybe there are some some psychiatric issues that need to be dealt with, like depression or anxiety, that some of those medicines can be adjusted some, and the patient can be on actually a little bit less opioids, and then they can go into surgery and be better managed in conjunction with a pain management team, and that even after surgery they can be managed that way. So, you know, it is a challenge for us as surgeons to take care of patients that are addicted to opioids, and I want to assure her that we will adequately take care of her pain when she's having surgery.
Well, and here's an email that sort of relates to what Maureen says. This person didn't want his or her name used. This person says, unfortunately, there's not a lot of training on how to use pain medication, and now they're scared to death to prescribe. This person says, I have a history of opiate abuse, but I have been for a long time seeing the right person to help me with this. Recently, I had a kidney stone, was upfront with everyone. I was in severe pain, but in the ER would not help me for the longest time. Even after my CAT scan and blood work verified a kidney stone, even after I consulted with my present doctor, who was okay with taking an opioid. This person says, I understand the concern, but it seems like overboard. It also seems like the politicians want to make feel-good rules and regulations and not truly address issues. So similar frustration to what we heard from Maureen. I wonder what you think, Dr. Nagel.
Yeah, I'm going to explain where all this comes from. There's a lot of myth about, you know, if nobody was dying, nobody would care. I'll be honest, nobody would care about this if people weren't dying, but they are. So the next question is, why are people dying? And I'm not going to try to answer that right now. But what I will say is this. There's a number. They were looking at risk factors for death from opioid overdose. So somebody looked at a linear assessment. We were going to talk about morphine equivalents of opioid. But, you know, how many milligrams equivalent of morphine you take a day, in theory, led to an increased risk of death. So that somebody came up with this number of 100. That if you take over 100, your risk becomes unacceptable. So they came up with a recommendation. This is based on the CDC guidelines. The CDC guidelines said that if you are on a dosage of over 100 milligrams, you need to have a consultation with a pain specialist, blah, blah, blah. They never at any point said arbitrarily should your dose be reduced. They never said that in the guidelines anywhere.
So there's a lot of confusion.
It was never said that in the New Hampshire law either. It just said that's what needs to happen if you're over 100. However, what they never did was when they looked at this data was look at the other drugs these people were taking. And now there's been a number of studies that have looked at this, that if you eliminate all the other drugs that people are on, the most common one are benzodiazepine sedatives, that combination in people over 100 milligrams of morphine equivalent becomes lethal.
So this is, again, gets back to what you keep saying. Doctors are rushed. Insurers want you to, you need to have these bigger conversations.
I'm not necessarily saying that. What I'm saying is that is that when a study in North Carolina data that was just published looked at independently looking at opioid dose over 100 milligram equivalent, they went up to 400 milligram equivalent. There was no dramatic death rate when you eliminated benzodiazepines, alcohol,
all the other stuff,
cannabis,
that people take.
Heroin.
I see what you're saying.
And a lot of people are self-medicating these days because they're not getting either access to care, they feel helpless, or we're not supposed to suffer, apparently. So, you know, people feel that any suffering is bad, so they're going to do whatever they need to do to stop that. So basically, that's where this 100 milligram number came from. And the insurance company is now accepting that as doctrine and saying, if you're over that, we're not going to pay for it. And so they're arbitrarily making people cut their doses. There's also doctors that are scared to death to prescribe at doses over that amount and arbitrarily cutting people back below 100 milligrams. And I think that's what she's talking about. That's where that number comes from.
I see. That's really interesting. So it's not necessarily X percentage or X milligrams of opioids that's the problem. It's this bigger mix of what people are.
Exactly. And the people that are dying out in the street, to be honest, about two studies now have demonstrated 90% of the deaths are due to illicit opioid, either, you know, illegal opioid or prescription opioid they've obtained illegally.
Go ahead, Michelle.
Yeah, so just a couple of points. One, we are also receiving, you know, phone calls from patients who have inferred that their practitioners are reducing them from, you know, the care that they've been on because, to Dr. Nagel's point, the rules say, you know, we got to get you off these, where, again, I point out and I hand them the rules and say, please go back to your prescriber. And it says it doesn't. It says consultation with a specialist.
So they blaming you?
No. They're just seeking out information. Mm-hmm. And we provide that information and to hopefully go back and educate their providers. And but I think the other issue we've talked about is, and one that we really don't have much control over, is the insurance side of things. And that's higher up in the legislative ladder. But the other point I want to bring about is some of the enhancement that we're looking to do with the prescription drug monitoring program through our strategic planning process is how we can better send educational alerts to prescribers when their patients may hit thresholds of concerns. So much like the CDC, you know, recommendations of when you hit the 100 MME daily amount, but when it's a concurrent benzo with that patient. And so again,
looking at the whole mix.
Correct. So if any prescriber would have a patient that has a combination of that, an alert would be sent to that provider, and all it does is gives that provider that record to say the next time you meet with your patient, because that provider may not have prescribed the benzodiazepine, they may be only prescribing the opioid and may not be aware that their patient is also taking a benzo or vice versa.
Well, that's partly what the prescription drug monitoring program is all about, right?
Correct.
Kind of pulling together all the threads of all the different
it is
physicians and practitioners
and
that people
and the
see.
Mandate to query is only if you're prescribing the opioid. So if you're prescribing a benzodiazepine, you're not required to query that patient's database.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's some missing information that might be helpful.
Correct.
According to you and Dr. Nagel. And by the way, MME is morphine milligram equivalent. Is that correct,
yes.
Michelle?
Thank
Here's
you.
An email that came in from Billy, who says, I had hand surgery last week at Concord Ortho. I was prescribed 10 pills of Vicodin, which was the ideal amount for the intensity and duration of pain I experienced. I would not consider myself a risk for opioid abuse, but I'm curious if there are any markers or warning signs to distinguish between a person who would be at risk for abuse as opposed to someone who wouldn't be at risk beyond a history of abuse. Well, thank you for the email. And Dr. Barth, what do you think about that? Because I think you told us earlier a subset of Americans are at greater risk for being addicted than the rest of the population.
Right.
So are there markers, like Will asks, you know, where you can say, Will, I don't think you should have these.
There aren't. I think we need to understand more about the nervous system and trying to identify patients who do develop a liking for opioids and become long-term users. The risk factors that we have out there are really pretty crude right now, just some whether people are, you know, have used opioids in the past or using other drugs like benzodiazepines in the past, or they've been alcohol users. You know, we have risk calculators that we use when we prescribe opioids for everyone, and you can get some idea of what their risk might be for those particular patients. Frankly, that doesn't necessarily change what I'm going to be prescribing for acute pain for those particular patients, because I know that they have acute pain. And for example, this person giving the getting the 10 Vicodin, that sounds like it's a pretty probably a pretty appropriate number for this, the surgery he had done. Frankly, 3 years ago, it probably would have gotten 30 or 40 pills.
Really?
Oh, yeah. And that's we've seen a huge change in what surgeons in particular are prescribing for acute pain like this. So I think he's getting prescribed the appropriate number now.
Well, I want to ask you about another type of drug that I have heard is being prescribed more because doctors are cutting back on opioids, and that's gabapentin. I've heard about other drugs like, I hope I'm pronouncing this right, pregabalin. Thank you.
Yeah.
What about these, Dr. Nagel? I mean, are these better? Are these just as problematic? I mean, what's sort of emerging for pain given the restrictions, rightly or wrongly, that doctors are placing on these drugs?
Well, the best news to come out of all of this, I will say, and I just did a symposium in Kansas City on this topic, was, you know, using the opioid crisis as an opportunity to find alternative measures to treat pain, because there's really been no significant new class of medication to come out in a long time.
And insurance coverage in terms of alternatives hasn't really changed very much
not
either.
Really.
Acupuncture,
well,
chiropractic.
It has a little bit.
Yeah.
A little bit. It's nudging that way. So that's good. But, you know, we talk about drugs that are useful for pain. Like, for example, for severe pain, unfortunately, really opioids are still it. I do agree for acute pain you should try other things first. But in the end, like when you're looking at chronic pain, end-of-life pain, things like that, we're still looking at opioids. These other things are referred to as adjunctive medicines. They were never designed to be standalone drugs. And we're talking about Neurontin, pregabalin, things like that. We used to think that those drugs were only helpful for what we call neuropathic pain, like postherpetic neuralgias and, you know, radiculitises and things like that. We're starting to think differently that they might be okay for standalone. My big concern is, though, these drugs are not free of side effects. They have significant side effects. Yeah, example, like you give that to an elderly person who's, you know, make them dizzy. The next thing you know, you have a broken hip, which is
good. Well, right. They're falling down.
Exactly.
That's
so,
not good.
You know, a lot of doctors are just saying, well, I can't use an opioid, so I'm going to use Neurontin or I'm going to use pregabalin. And I think, and the other thing that concerns me is these drugs are not that easy to prescribe. There's a lot of thought that needs to go into these things as well. And I'm watching some of my colleagues just kind of hurl doses at people without really knowing how to do it. And I mean, it's not that hard to learn, but it's time intensive, like especially Neurontin. That takes weeks to titrate somebody to the right dose.
What does titrate mean?
Gradually increase the dosage to an effective dose to avoid, you know, you want to look for a therapeutic window where they're getting the benefit without the side effects. So you have to titrate them slowly, and there's a process involved. And my colleagues don't, at least the ones that I work with, don't seem to understand that.
Well, I read yesterday the state of Kentucky, Dr. Barth, has classified gabapentin as a controlled substance. So, you know, what's out there?
There's lots of studies that show that actually gabapentin, when used prior to surgery, decreases the amount of opioids that are needed after surgery. So that's where we're using them in the acute care setting.
That's
so
interesting, before surgery.
Yeah, I did 4 operations yesterday on women with breast cancer, and all of them got some Tylenol and a little gabapentin prior to their surgery. We gave them intravenous form of Motrin during their surgery, used a lot of local anesthetics, and none of them needed opioids postoperatively.
Interesting.
So it's a combination of these other medications, I think, that can be used very effectively to diminish the number of patients that actually need opioid prescriptions after acute surgery.
Does the state's prescription drug monitoring program, Michelle, track non-scheduled drugs like gabapentin or... pronounce it again for me, Dr. Nagel.
Pregabalin.
Thank you.
We don't at this time, but I know that the Board of Pharmacy is definitely considering specifically gabapentin at this time. So we may look at putting it into the monitoring program just to monitor it, for practitioners to monitor it. We have gotten some anecdotal information from folks in the field that it is being abused and diverted. So we're going to gather more information, obviously. We're going to look at the ME's office to see if it's showing up in any of...
Medical examiner.
Right,
yeah.
I'm sorry, the medical examiner's office to see if it's showing up in any of the deaths. We're looking at law enforcement to see if it's showing up in any of the abuse cases.
Yeah, because again, in Appalachia, I've heard that it's starting to show up as problematic, even though it's not an opioid.
And many of the other... prescription drug monitoring programs around the country have already, if like Kentucky's different, they've actually brought it on as a scheduled drug. Others have brought it on as a non-controlled drug to monitor.
Oh,
and that might be something that New Hampshire would consider doing.
I see. Go ahead, Dr. Nagel.
You know, there's a market for everything. And there was this really neat study that was done in the 1990s in New York City where these DEA, they were state in New York cops. They basically went undercover and looked at different kinds of drug sales. And they identified two separate kinds, the kind that were selling drugs basically to get people high. The other people thought they were doing legitimate medical purpose, and they saw that they could make money doing it. And they were selling blood pressure medicine, all sorts of things that people couldn't get because they were uninsured or whatever, and they would sell well below the market rate. And they thought they were helping people because they actually queried them and asked, why are you doing this? He said, because somebody needs it. So they would sell the benzo eye of the day or whatever. And you kind of wonder if this is the same kind of thing. These are really expensive drugs. And a lot of people, feel that they need access to their insurances change, their doctors change on a regular basis, and they can't get access. So you kind of wonder if that kind of thing is going on. I'm really amazed that people could find ways to get high on these things, but nothing surprises me anymore.
Yeah, after 30 years of medical practice. Go ahead, Michelle.
No, the anecdotal that we've heard from the folks who are in the recovery side is they're actually melting it down and shooting it up. So
wow. So, Dr. Barth, if we got rid of opioids tomorrow, they all just all of a sudden disappeared. I mean, what would happen?
So there is a appropriate role for opioids in the acute care
setting that we
where we take care of patients. I think other countries just use them a lot less, say for example, than the United States uses them. And we're not looking to get rid of opioids. We're just looking for them to be appropriately prescribed for patients.
And they've been around for a long time. Yeah. I mean, morphine. All that. Yeah,
yes,
go ahead.
Yeah. I think we have to change patients' expectations regarding sort of an episode of surgery. So when a patient is prescribed some opioids, it's really for that episode to help relieve their pain. So one issue we haven't touched on yet is, well, what to do with the excess pills. So, we just talked about in our early study when we cut the prescribing in half, still only a third of the pills were being used. So two-thirds were still left over in the patient's medicine cabinet. And it's like, what to do with those excess pills? Well, patients, there are very well-defined ways. You can bring them back to drop boxes in the police stations or fire departments. You can mix them with water and dissolve them and throw them in your trash. But very few patients actually do that. And I think we're going to make an advance if we more appropriately take care of those excess pills in a higher proportion of patients. So that's our next study at Dartmouth. We're working on trying to increase the proportion of patients that dispose of them in an FDA-compliant manner and really changing patients' expectation about that prescription that is really just for that one acute episode of pain.
All right. We'll follow up with you when that happens, Dr. Barth. Thank you very much for being here. I really appreciate it. That's Dr. Richard Barth, Professor of Surgery at Dartmouth's Geisel School of Medicine. Dr. Nagel, good to see you. Thank you.
Thanks.
That's Dr. David Nagel, physician who specializes in pain management at Concord Orthopedics. And Michelle, it was nice to meet you. Thank you for being here. That's Michelle Rico-Jonas, Program Manager for New Hampshire's Prescription Drug Monitoring Program. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.